welcome to the latest episode of our Herbert Smith Freehills Public M&A podcast series. My name's Antonia Kirkby, and I'm joined today by Mark Bardell and Robert Moore, two of our public M&A partners who have recent experience of the topic we're going to be talking about today, which is competing offers. It's not that unusual to see possible competing offers, and we have seen quite a few of those recently, but much more interestingly and excitingly, we've also seen a number of firm competing offers in recent months, with four already announced this year. So we thought it'd be helpful today just to talk through these transactions and why we're thinking they're happening. So should we start with that question then? Why do you think we are seeing more competing bids?
So if I jump in and take that first, the first thing to note, I think, is obviously the UK system is designed so that bidders are flushed out relatively early in the process. You've got the whole Rule 2 put up and shut up regime. If you compare that to North American deals, they tend to be worked up in private and come public later in the process. So logically, it ought to be the case if you're getting flushed out earlier, actually, there ought to be more of these competing situations. And indeed, the way the takeover code in the UK is designed, it is a public process to allow for and indeed encourage competing bidders. So I think that's an important context to understand. And then you're looking for market factors which move you into a period of time when there are more competing bids. And I'd point to two factors in particular at this moment in time. One is there are more strategics, so i.e. listed companies or indeed privately owned companies, but companies rather than funds or PE sponsors in the market at the moment. And you can see that there's a number of securities offers being made, a number of strategic rationales driving strategic players to come out and make public bids. The other factor that I point to on the other side is PE sponsors are very active at the moment, seeing a valuation opportunity to buy companies perhaps at the mid end of the UK range. So there's a lot of activity behind the scenes for FTSE 250 at the moment.
Yeah, and I think all of that has been borne out over the last few months. So A, the step up of number of bids. If you take 2023 actual competing offers, there was only one. That was the competing offers for Kin and Carter. And interestingly, going to that point you just made, that was actually competing offers by PE bidders. Historically, bidders less willing to compete against each other than strategics for a variety of reasons. And then looking into this year, we have had this clear step up. So in terms of actual competing bids in the first 4 months of the year, we've had three, Spirent, Wincanton, Hypnosis, and actually a lot of potential competing bids. We think about DS Smith, Currys, and all the speculation about BHP.
Thanks both. So if we move on to the practicalities of how these transactions work, starting off at the beginning, how does the PUSU deadline situation work when you've got initially potential competing offerors and then a firm competing situation?
So that's a really important point to remember, which is the PUSU period is designed to get a bid out there and a target company in play. And therefore, if you follow that logic through, that explains why the rules operate such that the PUSU deadlines fall away if any one bidder makes an announcement of a firm intention to make an offer, then everybody else is free from PUSU. So that seems a little bit odd at first, but when you understand that context, that is why. Because the UK regime assumes that once a company is in play, then of course competing bidders will look at it and may well themselves make a bid. So I think the recent example of the bids for DS Smith are a good case study of how that works in practice. So first of all, there was a leak and an announcement by Mondi back in February of this year that it was considering an all-share merger with DS Smith. The Puzu deadline was imposed. That got extended once. Then there was a leak about International Paper. International Paper got its own Puzu deadline. And then the target company, DS Smith, realigned so that both parties were on the same Puzu deadline. It then turned out that International Paper got ahead. It was the one that made the 2.7. Therefore, the Puzu deadline in relation to Mondi fell away. And then there was a period of time. What was Mondi going to do next? And Mondi, in fact, withdrew at that point rather than get into a full-blown competing 2.7s out there. So they were both paper bidders, both obviously looking to consolidate in their sector, the packaging sector. And that, I think, is a very real example of how these things play out, competing bids in the early stages.
Thanks, Mark. And then if we move on to, you've got a firm offer that's announced, and as you say, the Puzu's fallen away, but then they have, if they're named, they have to clarify their intentions by day 53 or 7 days before the scheme meetings. What happens, though, if a bidder needs regulatory clearance? How does the timetable work in that situation?
Yeah, so on a contractual offer, there are obviously consequences to the timetable where there are regulatory clearances. The interesting point, though, comes when actually a second competing offer, to get the recommendation from the board, it may have the higher price, but what it actually needs to do is show that its bid is as deliverable as the first, and ideally within a very similar timeline. And so what that very often means is that a second bidder will need to take some regulatory risk, i.e. in the types of clearances that it seeks where they are not mandatory, or otherwise be able to give comfort to the board that about both the timing and the deliverability of its offer compared to the effectively the first offer that the board is sitting on. And Mark, I don't know if you've got, well, I do know you have recent experience with.
Yes. So again, just referring to the public information, Wincanton is an interesting example of that. That's a company in the logistics sector. The first bidder was CMA-CGM, the French ports operator, and the French ports operator had limited conditionality and had given a very strong hell or high water commitment around competition clearances in the UK. And bidder number two then arrived, which was GXO, US listed. And it is notable from their document that they had no condition in relation to UK CMA competition. So I think that's a helpful illustration of how if you are bidder number two and you need to win over the target, to your point, Bob, you would think not only about the price, but also about the deliverability and you know, addressing that regulatory clearance risk is a really important part in making sure that you can get the target board to switch horses and change to recommend bidder number two.
Thanks, Mark. So then if you move on through the kind of how these transactions sort of often play out, you quite often see one of the bidders declaring their offer to be final. What's that about? What effect does that have?
So I think that really comes down to the tactical question of you've got two potential bidders. What are they going to do? Are they going to fight publicly all the way to the end? Or is one of them going to drop out? And because the way the UK system works, both bidders with a 2.7 can't withdraw simply because there's a higher offer out there. They are bound by the regulation to continue with their bid. But what a bidder can signal, and sometimes this is a signal to their own shareholders, if it's a strategic company, that they won't be bidding any higher. They can make their offer best and final, and then it's all over to the other party as to whether the other bidder will increase and go further. So that is the tactical question. So I referred a moment ago to the DS Smith and Mondi example, and that was the choice Mondi made. I'm sure a message to its own shareholders that it wasn't willing to overpay, that was its final offer, and therefore it was effectively withdrawing.
Thank you. And then finally, and I feel like this might be a whole topic in itself, maybe for another episode, but when do you end up with an auction situation?
So I think the really important point to understand there is a panel auction, even though it's got that label under the rules, isn't really an auction at all. So in my mind, a true auction is in a private sell side process where the auctioneer, the selling company, appoints a winner and sells itself to that winning bidder. By contrast, the UK Takeover Panel's auction procedure is just a procedure of last resort that gets both parties to their best and final offer and then turns that question over to shareholders as to which of those offers shareholders want. So the auction procedure as a result is very rare in the UK. It's very exciting if you're involved in one of those. But it involves, you know, a series of public 2.7s, one bidder 2.7ing against another as you ladder up to the final and best offer for both. But such a giddy, high octane environment is a very expensive process to be involved in, which I suspect is why there are so few. So fun as an advisor if you get to be in one. But I think if you're a commercial counterparty, you want to avoid those at all cost. And there are very many other steps along the way to try and resolve these points, many of which we touched on earlier in this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you both for joining me today. Really interesting. And it'd be interesting to see how the year plays out. I suspect we may well see more competitive situations. And if we're lucky, an auction process. But as you say, Mark, probably unlikely. But thank you both for joining me today. And thank you too to our listeners. Do let us have any feedback on our podcast or topics for future episodes. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us and goodbye.
Thanks for listening. Bye.